Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the conference over to John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining NOAA's 1991 to 2020 U.S. Climate Normals Update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I will be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at, and I will spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. That's nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature a short presentation from three NOAA experts, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will be following can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. If you don't have that link, I will spell it for you now, and I'll do that slowly. The link is https://www.nbdc.noaa.gov/sotc/BRIEFINGS. And with that, I'll introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Michael Pilecki, Project Manager for the NOAA NCEI 1991 to 2020 Climate Normals, who will show some of the changes observed in the new normals compared to the old normals. Our second presenter is Ray Wolf, a meteorologist at NOAA's National Weather Service, who will provide information on how the National Weather Service and its partners use climate normals in day-to-day practice. And our third presenter is Imke Dura, project sponsor for the NOAA NCEI 1991 to 2020 climate normals, who will run down what will be included in the updated climate normals. And with that, we will kick off the call with Mike Pilecki from NOAA NCEI. Mike?
Thanks, John. I'd like to start out with slide two, please. And just to let you know, and climate normals are a little more than what you might expect from just a 30-year average of numbers. It's a whole grouping of different kinds of variables and the statistics behind them of our daily weather observations brought together to really clarify and quantify the climate for users. And so what we're trying to do with climate normals is to put today's weather in a proper context so we understand whether we're above a normal or below normal. And also we're trying to understand today's climate so people know what to expect and how to plan both for their personal activities and also for various economic sectors to plan. Going to slide three, the climate normals are designed to meet the needs of our user community. We've had several conferences and meetings with groups of users from all sorts of different economic sectors and also the climate and meteorology area, and they tell us what they would like to see, and we try to accommodate their needs. On the other hand, sometimes we are creative in our own ways and bring new products to bear, and you'll see a few of those too. So NOAA National Weather Service measures the weather and climate data that we predominantly use in our normals with its Cooperative Observer and ASOS networks, and you'll hear a little more about that in a minute. And then for the first time, we're also using data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's snow telemetry system and from the Citizen Science Group Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, or COCORAS. NOAA NCEI, the National the National Center for Environmental Information, is the official source of climate normals for stations in the United States that are used by the federal government. And these are not simple averages, as you'll find out. There's a lot of effort that goes into creating these normals. And most importantly, the takeaway is that today is not the release date, but it's our information date, so we can get the information out ahead of time. The release date is May 4th, 2021. So going to slide four, what do the new normals say? Well, last time we had about 9,800 stations worth of normals. This time, almost 15,000 stations with precipitation normals are going to be available, and more than 7,300 stations with temperature normals will be available. And we also have hourly normals for our stations at airports and important locations that will be about 480 of those available. So what we found is that the warming from the 1981 to 2010 to 1991-2020 normals is pretty widespread but not ubiquitous. There are some areas that actually have cooler temperature normals, especially in the spring in the north central U.S. Precipitation changes between the old normals and the new normals vary considerably from month to month across the U.S., but we're generally getting wetter in the southeast and central U.S. And so in slide five, I just have a teaser here, an example of what the changes look like in April, going from the new normals minus the old normals. So you see the difference. And you can see that in the green on the left side of the diagram, we have wetter conditions in the southeast and central U.S., drier in the southwest. You can also see that in the temperature diagrams on the right, especially maximum temperature, which is the upper right diagram. It's quite a bit cooler, actually, in the Dakotas and Minnesota and the north central U.S. and warmer in both the southwest west and the southeast. Okay, with that, I'd like to pass this along to slide six and my colleague Ray Wolf.
Thank you, Mike. The National Weather Service shares the 30-year normals routinely in our daily and monthly climate summaries for stations across the U.S. In fact, this is actually one of our most popular products that includes the daily high and low temperature, how much rain or snow fell, how much snow is on the ground. And this information is commonly used in television weather broadcasts, in newspapers, and other media venues. And as Mike indicated, the 30-year normals also allows us to provide a context for weather and extreme events anywhere from daily time scales to annual time scales. And an example I'll draw from recently here, the average temperature during that February cold outbreak in Texas at Dallas-Fort Worth on February 16th was 42 degrees below normal. That quantitatively really puts a perspective on just how substantial that event was. And this type of information is commonly used in local news stories and shared via social media. Also, the Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center outlooks from week two through seasonal timeframes references the chances of above or below normal temperatures and precipitation relative to these 30-year normals. And in fact, the outlooks starting on May 20th will reference the new set of outlooks. In addition to Weather Service and in working with our partners, the data is used broadly, and this is just really a snippet. But for example, for drought assessment, various drought indices that are used in deriving the National Drought Monitor compare the differences between the observed data and the normal data to see how far we are departing from the normal climate and how that might have implications for drought. Freeze risk, very timely with what's going on in the central U.S. Farmers and gardeners plan production practices considering the dates and risk of spring and fall freezes based on normals of these two events. And what we've seen here, for example, in the core of the Midwest, we're right about our normal freeze date in some areas, but the vegetation has developed a week or two ahead of normal. That's based on input from state cooperative extension specialists that we work with. So we know with early development of vegetation that the freeze risk from a climatological perspective is higher than normal. Energy companies will monitor heating and cooling degree days, and these two parameters are useful when assessing energy usage. For example, are we unusually hot in the wintertime or unusually cold in the summertime, which might minimize energy use versus being hot in the summer and cold in the winter, which might maximize energy use. Snow normals can be used by local government for budget planning purposes and operations planning for snow removal. And out west especially, a knowledge of the mountain snowpack and whether the accumulation of snow and snow water equivalent is above or below normal is important for water resource planning. And then travel, whether for vacation or business, the nice thing about normals is you can look at normals from anywhere in the country at any time of the year and get a sense for what the weather is typically like in an area that you're planning to visit. So on to slide 8, the question might arise, well, where exactly does this data come from? And one of the sets of data, ASOS, the Automated Surface Observing System, comes from airport weather stations across the country. You might have seen these when you're flying along, driving along the taxiways or runways out in the center field of the airport. There are about 900 of these stations maintained by the Weather Service, the FAA, and the Department of Defense. And these are sources for daily and monthly local climate observations. In addition to temperature and precipitation, they also include dew point, wind speed and direction, and information about clouds and visibility. The latter two are particularly important for airport operations and service the aviation industry, but also benefit the climate community as well. Going on to slide 9. Another area where we get data from that Mike mentioned is the Cooperative Observer Weather Program. This was established in 1890, consists of about 10,000 volunteers gathering observations daily at about 8,100 weather stations across the country, one of the neatest citizen science programs we have. And most of these stations will collect daily maximum and minimum temperature, 24-hour precipitation, snowfall, and snow depth. And again, Weather Service offices maintain these weather sites and provide a preliminary quality control of data before forwarding to NCEI. And as we move on to slide 10, I will hand off to IMCA from NCEI.
Thank you, Ray, and we will pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about what is included in the normals that we are releasing in about 2 weeks, and also why we are producing normals for 30 years. So starting on that front, the World Meteorological Organization in the mid-1930s requested that its member countries, of which the United States is one, compute climate normals for the 30-year period 1901 to 1930. And it so happens that 30 values are a little bit of a statistical standard for computing robust means. And also it was a relevant length of time considering the amount of time for which observations had been available in many parts of the world at the time. So going forward, every 30 years, countries are asked by the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, to recompute their 30-year normals. And 1991 to 2020 is now the latest period. Many countries, including the U.S., have actually computed normals every 10 years, always ending with the end of a year, an end of a decade, or a year ending in zero. So 30 years is one convenient way to compute these climate normals, but it by no means is necessarily the right answer for what the length should be. And in a time of changing climate, many industries have found that they have a use for shorter period normals, for instance, the last 15 years, thinking that this may describe the current state of the climate more accurately, especially when it is used to forecast conditions in the near future. And so 15-year normals are one alternative of creating 30-year normals. The WMO provides guidelines for how to compute normals, and NOAA, in its latest version of normals, has followed those guidelines to a large extent, with some regional modifications that are also permitted under those guidelines. And so NOAA is releasing the 1991 to 2020 normals to replace the previously produced 1981 to 2010 normals. And in addition, we are releasing a full set of all of the same statistics for the 15-year period of 2006 to 2010. Moving on to slide 11, we'll talk about what is included in the climate normals. And I want to actually start with the examples at the bottom of this slide and ask you to consider what you might want to know about a certain location. If, say, you would like to travel there or live there, or if you intend to open a certain business there or you need to clean the roads there. So here are some examples of what is included in the normals. You might find the average temperature for a month, for instance, January, at a specific location, or the average annual precipitation. So how much does it rain over the entire year in a place? Or then we get to things like the third quartile of February snowfall, the third quartile, I should say, the third quartile of February snowfall. And this is a way to measure that one-fourth of all snowfalls exceed that value. And also you might want to know how many days in July have a temperature exceeding 90 degrees, for example. Or what is the average low temperature on April 20th? And all of these are examples of the kinds of statistics that you will find in the climate normals. Overall, we have statistics for hours of the day and each day of the year, for daily observations, for daily values, for monthly timescales, seasonal timescales, and the year as a whole. As you could see from the examples, there are averages, there are frequencies, there are terciles, quartiles, and quintiles. And not all of these parameters are available for all variables, but those are just some examples of the kinds of statistics you will find. And the variables for daily to annual timescales include precipitation and snowfall. For hourly to annual timescales, you'll have temperature. And then just at the hourly timescale, we will also have dew point, sea level pressure, cloud cover, and wind speed and direction. On slide 12, we highlight with two examples why the normals are not just simply a 30-year average or 30-year statistic that you can just simply compute when you pull out your calculator and look at some data. First, I might just mention that the exact data set you use may also inform what your exact calculation would yield. Secondly, NCEI adjusts its monthly temperature time series for inhomogeneities that are caused by changes in observation time, changes in station location, changes in instrumentation. And in the figure on the slide, you can see an example of this. The red time series here shows the raw monthly temperatures at Dayton, Ohio. The blue time series shows the adjusted or homogenized temperature series. And you can see that the differences between the two series can be approaching 2 degrees Fahrenheit at different parts of the record. And some of these changes that you see in the differences are correlated with known changes in instrumentation at the station. Others may not be documented, but maybe something changed anyway at the station and didn't get captured. The homogenization that is applied is intended to remove those kinds of discontinuities or jumps in series that are caused by artificial changes, so that once you have an homogenized series, you can compute a more accurate normal that is then relevant and relative to the current location and instrumentation. And another aspect of the climate normals as we compute them from station data is that the data are not always complete. Observers, especially human observers, which account for most of the observations we use, are not always home, as you know. And so not all of the data end up being available. Some stations were not operational throughout the entire 30-year period. They closed earlier or started later or had a gap in observation. And so we need to use various techniques for handling completeness. One is listed here that we restrict the data that we use in the case of precipitation and for the computation of average monthly precipitation totals to months that have a complete set of precipitation observations, because otherwise you may be missing that one heavy rainfall event that would have really changed your total. And that requires then that we try to estimate monthly values for other months for which we do not have enough data. Those are just some examples for the statistical considerations that go into the calculation of normals. And on slide 13, you will see some references to publications that describe the methods that we used in the climate normals. These are largely the same methods that were already used for the 1981 to 2010 normals, with some adaptations to meet customer feedback that we have received, and also to accommodate updated guidelines from the World Meteorological Organization. And with that, I will pass it on to back to my colleague, Mike Pilecki, to talk about more about changes in the normals and the product lines.
Okay, thank you, Imka. I'm going to just quickly show you some more of the results of our normals. One of the main things in slide 14 that you'll see is our newest form of normals is high-resolution gridded normals for temperature and precipitation, monthly normals, and this is just an example of the maps you can make with that kind of product. That will be coming out about the same time or a little later than the station normals on May 4th. If you go to slide 15, you can see that using these gridded normals, you can see the differences in normals between the old normals and the new normals. We calculated both here, are shown to vary from month to month. And you can see, especially here in the southeast, it's warm in October, it's cool and cooler in November, warmer in December. So not every month and every location in the U.S. is always warming, despite the fact that we generally are warming in our climate. And we also find when we look at the annual normals changes at some select U.S. cities in this table on slide 16, that the precipitation changes can be positive from the last normals to the current normals, or the new normals, I should say, which are in green and in yellow, they're drier. But notice when you add it all up for the whole annual average temperature, almost every place in the U.S. has warmed from the 1981 to 2010 normal to the 1991 to 2020 normal. And you can see that in this particular graph on the next slide, number 17, that again, wetter in the east, drier in the west, and pretty much warmer everywhere else. But there's actually a better way to look at this as a measure of how climate change is affecting things is if we relate this to the whole 20th century average from 1901 to 2000. And you can see this in slide 18, that the current normals are indeed much wetter in the eastern U.S. than is typically found in the 20th century, and also much warmer everywhere. So you can see that climate change is clearly seen in these new normals. And in fact, we can recreate the normals for all the other previous 30-year periods in our record. Starting on slide 19, you can see that precipitation normals have changed and varied from time to time, some periods drier, some periods wetter. But in the last three normals, we've been driving towards a much wetter environment in most of the U.S. And then on slide 20, you can see that there's a huge difference in temperature over time as we go from cooler climates in the early part of the 20th century to ubiquitously warmer climates here in the last two sets of normals. So we're really seeing the fingerprints of climate change in the new normals. We're not trying to hide that. We're, in fact, reflecting that in the new normals so that we keep track of the climate so people know what the climate is now. We use other data sets to show the climate change over time, but this is a really neat one to look at. So with that, I'd like to go to slide 21. There's more information on the slide. I'm not going to go into this right now, but we would thank you for your time and pass it back to John. Thank you.
All right. Great. Thanks a lot, Mike. Now we will take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible. And Terry, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Thank you. And if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And one moment. Okay, and our first question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. And your line is now open.
Thank you. It is a little confusing since you're saying May 4th and giving us some data today. Can you give us some, there's two big things that confuse me here, so if I can ask them both. First, can you go through the average annual national temperature for the new 30-year time period, the new normal, and every previous normal that you have going back on that, I guess it was slide 20. So, I mean, to show that change. And then going back to slide 16, this is just a math geeky question, but it's really important for accuracy. You have the columns precip and mean temperature. Are those the current normal, the new normal precip and mean temperature, or are those the old normal precip and mean temperature? Because for those of us who like to do percentage change, that's very important. Thank you. And that's for
Mike. Yeah, I'll go ahead and take that one. This is Michael. What I'm showing in the table in slide 16 are the changes in inches of precipitation at these station locations that were kind of randomly selected. And that's the difference between the 1981 and 2010 subtracted from the 1991 to 2020 normal. And so you can see the 1991 to 2020 normal, for instance, is 4 inches more precip falling in Asheville, North Carolina. And the temperature annually, mean average temperature, is 1.5 degrees warmer. So there's considerable change going on at that location. And that's the same idea that was this is just comparison of the new normal with the previous normal. In slide 20, we're comparing all 30-year periods, including the new normal, 91 to 2020, with the 20th century average, which runs from 1901 to 2000. So that 100-year period average is subtracted from each of the normals periods to show how, and this is using the same color scheme for each one, so you can see that in the early part of the record, the normals from the start of the 1900s were cooler than the 20th century average, and now here in the 21st century, 1991 to 2020, the normals are much warmer than the 20th century average. Does that answer your question?
No, it actually does not. Can I restate my question so maybe you can understand a little better? Maybe I didn't state it better. So first, on slide 16, I understand you're giving me change. If you look at the precip, let's look at Asheville, North Carolina, 49.59.
Yes.
Is that the new normal that ends in the year 2020, or is that the old normal? That's all I need to know.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is the new normal.
That is the new normal, okay, because
yes.
That's important when you're doing percentages. So the other question that I really didn't quite communicate well, I guess, is I am looking for the average national, the new normal annual U.S. temperature, and I'm looking for that for each of the old normals that you have done that shows basically with the math instead of the pictures what you're showing. In other words, yeah, I mean, I know, I understand that slide 20 is showing compared to 20th century average, but I want to say, for example, that the new normal, the average annual temperature is 58 degrees, that in the old normal was 57.6, and in the 71 to 2000 normal is 57.4. That is what I'm looking for.
All right. I understand what you're saying. I don't have those calculations with me right now. We can certainly get those for you after the fact. And that's, you were Seth, is what
yes,
I heard,
I'm
Seth Borenstein?
Yes.
And this is John Bateman. Seth, you're welcome to reach out to me as well, and I can connect you with Mike.
But this is clearly man-made climate change, you're saying, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Tom Henry with Toledo Blade, and your line is now open. And Tom Henry, unfortunately, we cannot hear you. Do you have us on mute?
For some reason.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, you can go ahead with your question.
Okay. Yeah, I'm at the Toledo Blade here in the Great Lakes region, and for years, you know, we've heard that the Great Lakes region is getting warmer and wetter, but I wondered if you had just any other general observations to make about this this part of the country.
Well, I guess I'll take that one. This is Michael again. Definitely, both are correct. On an annual basis, precipitation has increased anywhere from 5 to 10% in the Great Lakes area, and also the temperature has increased somewhere between half and a whole degree Fahrenheit on an annual basis. You'll see differences in different seasons. Like I showed earlier, the spring is not necessarily a warming time of year up there, but it's more than made up for by warming in other parts of the seasonal cycle. And so definitely climate change is affecting the Great Lakes and its normals. Yep.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Sean Sublett with Climate Central, and your line is now open.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for this labor of love. This is tremendous work, and I want to thank you all very much for it. A two-pronged question to Michael and Ray. Michael, this is kind of a more of a logistic one and should be fairly brief. Regarding the May 4th release of the data, do you have a UTC time where that might be released so we can go play with it? And also, is that when we should see similar updates to the NOAA NCEI site? And second question would be for Ray, as we look at that small cooling signal in the Dakotas, upper Midwest, do we have at least, and you know, I wouldn't hold you to this, but so much, of course, being a meteorologist myself, do you have any kind of early explanations to why that signal is there regarding maybe changes in agriculture, changes in precipitation amounts, snow melt trends, or something like that? Thank you all very much.
Just for the logistical part of that, 11 a.m. Eastern time, which I believe is, what is that, 16 UTC, I believe? Oh, no, I can't remember. It's 15 UTC, I think. So when we'll have the official release time on May 4th. So, sorry, I'm a little rusty on my UTC conversions from daylight savings time. Go ahead, Ray.
And, Sean, for the northern plains, I know in the semi-arid environments, I'm looking at Mike's map of how the normal precipitation that area has become much wetter. And certainly, especially if that occurs during the summertime, the amount of energy that would be going into evaporating that water and transpiring it through plants would not be available to warm the climate. And it's been well documented in the center part of the U.S., in Iowa, in the heart of the Corn Belt, that there is sort of a summer cooling, or at least an area that's not warming as much. But I would say my comments on what's going on in the northern plains are probably somewhat speculative at this point and would require a more in-depth analysis.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News, and your line is now open.
Thank you. In the list of cities, I noticed that New York is conspicuously absent. Do you have New York City?
We have data for many places, but I was limited in my scope for this particular diagram, so I don't have the numbers right in front of me. I can certainly get that to you after the fact.
Okay. Thanks.
And our next question comes from John Boyer with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and your line is now open.
Hey, thank you so much, and thanks for doing this. I'm looking back at those new gridded normals on slide 14, and I might have missed it, but does remote sensing data factor in at all for that, particularly when we're looking at that precipitation, or is it based entirely on interpolated station data? And further, would that be available May 4th for any kind of download as like a shapefile or KMZ, or are you looking at it through some kind of web viewer?
Inka, do you want to talk about the source? Inka, you're muted.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, now I can.
Okay, sorry. To your first question, the gridded data are solely based on interpolating in situ observations, and we can speak more about the methodology for that. But the gridded normals are going to be available around May 4th, and they will be available currently in a NetCDF format, which can be imported into a variety of tools. We are also working on providing some other formats, but I'm not sure yet if they will be available. They probably won't be available right around the same time.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Don Jenkins with the Capital Press. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My question, I'm trying to, with the addition of the USDA Snowtell sites, because that's a lot of information that wasn't used 10 years ago. So just to understand, is the addition of that information how does that affect the norms that you're incorporating it this time around and you didn't have them last time?
Inka, would you like to answer that?
Yes, I'll take that. So for the station normals that we are releasing on May 4th, since each station is somewhat independent of other stations, the effect of adding the Snowtell sites primarily fills in locations. And right now, we're only releasing Snowtell normals for precipitation and not any other variable at this time. We may add other variables in the future, but that is all we're doing. And so that basically increases your coverage, especially in the western high altitudes. The Snowtell sites also do contribute to the gridded normals, which we have used here in this presentation to show the changes in the normals. And there, too, they primarily improve the interpolation errors or, reduce the errors you might have otherwise in the western mountains.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Tom Henry with Toledo Blade, and your line is now open.
Yeah, I was just trying to do this as a follow-up before I got cut off. farmers, I'd like your example of farmers in the Midwest who would benefit from a better understanding of climate normals. I know our first day in the field talking to some farmers out here, one guy's been tracking it, and almost every year he said the trending data is that his first day in the field gets pushed back by about 25 or about a month over the last 25 years. But I'm just wondering if you had some other practical examples of how people in the Great Lakes region might be using these normals, whether it's for shipping or other industries or vacationers, just, you know, specific to this region, if there are any examples you can think of other than farming that might be good uses for this kind of trending data.
Ray, Mike, would you like?
Yes, I'll take a shot, Mike, and then maybe pass it back to you. I know one of the implications would be on the temperature side would be the impact of the warming on ice out on the Great Lakes and opening up shipping. I don't have specifics on that, but NOAA's got a great research center up there, the Great Lakes Environmental Lab, who any questions related to lake-related issues are an excellent resource. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any. Ag is such a big thing in Ohio and southern Michigan there. That's one of the big drivers.
I'd pick that up and suggest that most utilities, of course, are required by state regulators to use some set of normals, often the 30-year conventional normals, to estimate the amount of energy they'll be using, so for rate setting, and they sometimes are allowed to cost share with their clients if they need to burn more energy than expected because the winter is colder than expected, or there's more electricity needed for summer air conditioning, that kind of thing. So it goes into important calculations there. There are other industries, of course, that use these data, such as advertising wonderful places to go and vacation along the Great Lakes and so forth. So there are construction needs, for instance. How many days does it rain during a certain period of the year so that you can build that into your planning for your construction schedules, that kind of thing. So there's a variety of other uses for normals that we haven't covered, but those are some of them. Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Seth Bornstein with the Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm assuming this is only U.S., right? No global. If you can answer that, and where in terms of both location and in terms of seasonality did you see the highest change in terms of temperature on normal, highest increase? In other words, what region or city had the biggest increase in temperature with a new normal, and what season or month did we see nationally the biggest increase or in temperature on the new normals? And that's for...
Yeah. Okay. So the last question first was I think we've seen our largest increases in temperature in the Southwest U.S., and although it really depends on which season you're looking at. In fact, one of the surprises to me, having grown up in New England, New England had quite a bit of warming going on there, especially in the summertime, compared to other parts of the country. What was your first question? I'm afraid I missed that one.
If you haven't looked at global new normal.
No, this is just going to be looking at the U.S. Each country is designated by the World Meteorological Organization to create their own normals, and we will be the collector of the normals and the National Centers for Environmental Information, and we'll be sending those, putting those together in a website in calendar year 2022. Their members are given a year and a half to 2 years to create their normals, and they'll send them to us. Yep.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Andrew Pershing with Climate Central, and your line is now open.
Hi. I really appreciate all the work that goes into these. It's a tremendous resource for many of us. I'm curious whether the change you observed, especially looking at the shift between the previous normal and this new normal, whether that's consistent with the climate projections.
This is Michael again. I think some of them are, in general, there is an expectation of warming for most of the continent and for wetter conditions in the east and drier conditions in the western U.S. And I think that's generally in agreement with mid-century kinds of projections for climate related to increasing greenhouse gases. The actual month-to-month patterns can vary quite considerably because we're also changing atmospheric circulation at the same time. Other feedback, such as changes in snow cover and the seasonality in the spring, et cetera, can lead to things looking a bit different than they do in climate models because climate models aren't perfect, but we're generally seeing a lot of the expected signals showing up, yes.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Erica Groh with WPIX-TV New York, and your line is now open.
Thank you. This question might be more for Inca than anyone else because you talked about specifically the reason for using the 30-year climate normals, and I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. Is there a statistical reason that 30 years works? I know you mentioned the way that computers work, but as far as, like you said, or one of the other panelists said, okay, so maybe I'm looking to move to a different part of the country. I want to know what to expect. Does 30 years kind of encompass the range of possibilities between the lowest 10% and the 90th percentile? You know, is there a good reason that 30 years works?
Yes, I can take that. I think that 30 years is somewhat of a hybrid between a very long record, which might not be available at as many locations. You know, the longer you make the record, the more difficult it is to find consistent, sufficiently complete time series for actually making the calculation. And yet it still encompasses multiple decades, you know, three, so that's not a large number of decades, but more than one. And so it does capture at least some of the decade-to-decade variability already. And so I'm not sure I can put it in terms of the, you know, percent of likelihoods or so, but in terms of especially the average conditions, 30 years seems to be quite reasonable. We can and we do make the calculations for as short as 10 or 15 years, understanding, though, that is, you know, potentially representing only one decade. And so if there was a particularly warm or cold long-term condition during that time, that may affect the calculation more than it would if we had a longer period. And there are some variables such as extreme precipitation for which 30 years is probably not enough. And that is one reason why we don't do any climatologies for the really extreme values.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Alan Just with Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and your line is now open.
Hi. So kind of related to the question of extreme values, I'm wondering about the occurrence of events that impact human health and whether you've combined information on temperature and some of these others, such as dew point, and looked at anything like a heat index or apparent temperature to look at the frequency or expectation of particularly extreme heat events.
This is Michael.
I can take that. Yes.
Go ahead,
so in our hourly normals, we include the heat index and also a wind chill index that gets at some of what you're thinking of in terms of the human experience of those conditions. We also do have the number of days on which the temperature exceeded a certain threshold, or precipitation, or snowfall, for instance, which also can help measure how extreme or impactful the climate is. It often is a more relatable statistic for people than the average, say, temperature for a month.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Don Jenkins with the Capital Press, and your line is now open.
Thank you. Is the climate data from 1901 to 1930 sufficient to make a comparison between the climate from that 30-year period to the climate period from 1991 to 2020?
The values that are we're looking at in terms of the maps you're looking at are gridded normal, so we're pooling all the available data, and there's quite a bit of available data in the early 20th century onward, given that the co-op network started in the 1890s. So, in fact, we do have sufficient data. It's not there is more error in that map than in the current map, because of some lack of coverage in parts of the West. But for the most part, those maps are quite reliable because we're combining the data from all stations. However, if you want to look at an individual station, there aren't very many that have data continuously from that 1901 to the current time. That's why that's something that we can better look at with these pooled data sources such as gridded normals rather than individual station normals. Thank you.
Thank you. And unfortunately, we do not have time for any further questions, so I will now turn the conference back over to John.
All right. Thanks, Terry. And we had a lot of great questions. So if you do have any more, you're more than welcome to email me. My contact information is available at the top of the media advisory I sent out. It's also online. And once again, we can connect you with any of our experts that spoke today. If you just email me, that email address is nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. I'd also like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for some upcoming dates. First of all, the release of the April 2021 U.S. Climate Report is scheduled for May 7th, and the release for the April 2021 Global Climate Report is scheduled for May 13th. And lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on NOAA.gov, and that will be on the media advisory that is posted there, and that will go online later today for you to listen to. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.